minute early, I don't know, but with lawyers, early is better than late, right? So welcome to the West panel. I'm honored to be serving this week with Judge Patrick Higginbotham of Texas, and Judge Higginson and I are holding down part of the Louisiana contingent. Regrettably, most of these cases come from Texas, so we are doing our best to unravel them. But we have interesting cases this morning, so we're going to call the first case up, 23-30288, United States versus Foster and Dalton. Mr. Farrell.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Justin Harrell, and I represent Mr. Mark Dalton. Carjacking is a peculiar species of robbery. It's one that requires two independent and mutually exclusive showings. One, the use of force or threats of violence to procure the vehicle, and two, independently of that, a demonstration of the defendant's subjective intent, his specific intent, to commit either murder or great bodily injury in the achievement of his goal. We submit, Your Honors, that in these cases, the government failed and the evidence was absent in terms of demonstrating this latter element of specific intent. There are two robberies, two carjackings that occurred in this case. The first was on April 10th of 2020. The victim in that case was Mr. Eddie Prophet, who passed away prior to trial for reasons unaffiliated with this matter. In his stead, the government admitted film captures and film surveillance from the cash and carry on Sheffman Tour Highway, which depicted the offense. That footage appears, seemingly, to show Mr. Mark Dalton approaching Mr. Prophet. Mr. Dalton has in his hand what was described at trial as a shiny metallic object. He brandishes the object at Mr. Prophet, who drops his car keys and basically surrenders his person. At that point, two additional individuals approach on the video monitor. They appear to pat down Mr. Prophet for valuables. They recover the car keys and they escort Mr. Prophet to the vehicle, which departs the scene. As to Mr. Dalton, after having approached the victim, after having brandished this metallic object, he makes an abrupt about face and exits screen left and is not seen at any further time in the video. It is not known if he entered the vehicle at any time during the robbery. What occurs, if anything, inside of that car is a veritable black box that we will never know, and the jury certainly was unaware. What we do know is that the film footage does not depict that brandishing plus, that extra element that extends beyond.
When you say there has to be that extra element, you ask the district court to instruct on that?
I do not recall if there was a specific instruction with regards to the brandishing.
But you're citing to us the Ninth Circuit Randolph decision.
I'm citing.
You did in your brief, correct?
I did in the brief as
and,
well.
And that case was explicitly abrogated by Holloway, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So why would you cite it if it's abrogated?
Because I believe it's in the spirit of Holloway. I don't believe Holloway discards that reasoning.
It's in the spirit of Holloway. But Holloway, the Supreme Court explicitly identified the Randolph decision that you're citing to us as one that they're abrogating.
I cited Holloway as my main authority in this case, Your Honor, because I believe the Supreme Court at that point indicates that both elements must be supported independently.
You understand my concern about the brief?
Yes, Your Honor.
Citing an authority that's been abrogated?
I believe I cited the authority for some of the verbiage that I think is appropriate, but I think I maintained and supported the brief on the holding of Holloway.
So Holloway says, to me, it says that conditional intent element doesn't exist when there's an empty threat or a bluff.
That's correct.
So it would seem to me if I'm a defense attorney, I want to ask for that exact instruction. That's why I asked, did you ask for a Holloway-type instruction?
I was not the trial counsel, and I'm unaware.
Did the trial counsel ask for it?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Did the trial counsel ask for it?
I'm not aware if the trial counsel asked for an instruction along those lines. What I am aware of is that authority does maintain that the brandishing of a weapon or a shiny metallic object might be sufficient to meet the force and the threat element, but it's not sufficient in and of itself to also support this separate, mutually exclusive factor of specific intent to kill or create great bodily harm. If that was the case, then clearly Congress would have not needed the additional verbiage, which is very explicitly set forth in the statute. So we believe that the surveillance footage simply cannot support both elements as it concerns Mr. Dalton. There's nothing in the footage that demonstrates additional threats, comments, screaming, hollering, cocking of a weapon, striking, threatening to strike, anything of that nature with regards to Mr. Prophet.
I mean, it's a carjacking. As you said, it's a unique, you know, species. It's beyond purse snatching. It's a carjacking.
It is, Your Honor. And if the carjacking itself was considered so inherently dangerous that the mere crime carried with it automatically a presumption of intent to kill or create bodily harm, then that language would not be necessary in the statute. So the statute clearly sets forth the two elements which both must be met.
You didn't ask for a specific, not you, if it wasn't asked for a specific instruction to channel the jury elseways, how can you argue that from the video and the footage, these guys with the hoodies and the guns and all the circumstances under which it transpires, it cannot be inferred the requisite intent? I don't understand that argument.
I guess the argument is, Your Honor, even if trial counsel failed to make the request the instruction, that does not itself abrogate the U.S. Supreme Court precedent or due process requirements that every element must be separately supported.
Well, my question is, you know, you didn't ask for a specific instruction, not you. If that wasn't there, from the circumstances described here, et cetera, how can you argue that it's reversible error for the necessary inference to be there to satisfy the element needed?
Because I think the law is clear that the single act that's depicted in the footage, which is the brandishing of what is presumably a weapon, cannot meet both elements of the statute.
It's fact-driven. It's fact-driven. You can't run away from the facts.
Certainly not. Certainly not.
But the fact remains. In the old days, we say when the facts are against you, you argue the law. When the law is against you, you argue the facts. And it just seems to me this is a case where the facts are definitely against you, speaking for one person. So you're arguing the law, but I'm just not honing in on exactly how you say there's a legal deficit that equals reversible error on the facts that a fact finder could derive from you. That's the piece I'm trying to follow.
And that's that piece, Your Honor, comes from the fact that Mr. Dalton commits one physical act, one factual event occurs in the April 10th carjacking, and that is when he approaches Mr. Prophet, he brandishes a weapon. That is the only fact that is before the court. That's the only fact that was before the jury. And based upon that fact, it would seem the jury made an inference of multiple elements were satisfied. And it is that inference that we believe was irrational because the jury cannot assume both the threat of violence or the use of force and the requisite intent from the same fact as per the United States Supreme Court's rulings. That concerns the April 10th, 2020 carjacking. There was a second carjacking that occurred 2 days later on April 12th in the Bayou St. John neighborhood of New Orleans. In that case, the two victims, Desmond McGee and Christian Pira, survived the ordeal. They testified at trial. Both men identified Mr. Dalton as having arrived on the driver's side of the vehicle, brandished a weapon, and instructed the men to get into the back seat of the car. At that point, we would submit that the force or use of threat of violence prong was met. Once the gentleman complied with that demand, Mr. Dalton turned over his handgun to an individual subsequently identified as Mr. Foster. Mr. Foster enters the back seat of the vehicle. Suffice it to say, as I'm running out of time, that during the course of those events, Mr. Dalton made several overtures and comments to the victims to the effect that he was not intending to harm them, that he was going to return the vehicle, drop off the occupants, and that they would not be harmed so long as they complied.
I'll give you an extra minute since you shifted to the second offense, if you want to complete the thought on that.
Yes, Your Honor. Simply to say, in the second offense, I do not believe they were actions committed by Mr. Dalton that meet that second prong of specific intent to kill. I believe he made comments and statements during the course of the event as to his intent that these people would arrive safely and be released safely at some point. I believe the government leaned on the phrase dumped, which was uttered by Mr. Foster, but I do not believe there's any analog in standard English language to understand the word dump, which means to discard hastily, also implies murder. So I do not believe that the testimony of McGee and Pira as to the word dumped satisfies that separate element of the specific intent to kill. And I have nothing further.
All right. Thank you, sir. You've preserved your rebuttal time. All right. Thank you, Mr. Atkinson.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Ian Atkinson on behalf of Harold Foster. Mr. Foster has adopted Mr. Dalton's Rule 29 arguments below and on appeal. There's substantial overlap between our positions, so I will try to be brief. Mr. Foster's arguments also rely on the language in Holloway that they're...
You're relying primarily on that Sixth Circuit case that does post-date Holloway, right? It does seem to require brandishing plus. That's the case you cite, Fakit.
If that case was cited incidental to the other authorities in our brief.
You didn't cite the pre-Holloway decision. You did cite a significantly post-Holloway. So that's a significant case. Do you remember that case, the Sixth Circuit Fakit? Do you remember citing it? And it's
yes, I recall citing the case, Your Honor. I mean, I would say that my argument, as I intended it in my brief and as I'm making it today, is a Holloway argument. It's not that brandishing plus is required. Oh. It's that you have to show an intent to kill or harm at the precise moment of taking the car. And I don't believe that that was... proven in this case, especially with respect to the April 10th carjacking, because of the very particular type of proof that the government offered.
There's video and there's victim statements both.
Well, essentially, it's really just the video on the April 10th case, because the victim himself, other than saying I was carjacked, to a relative, he passed away, right? So we filed a motion for new trial. The district court assigned written reasons, and the district court essentially said the video, more or less standing alone, was sufficient to show specific intent on this April 10th carjacking. And now, you know, this is it's a very unusual case.
The video shows brandishing of a gun, so it does come back to whether brandishing alone suffices. And we
That's
know
correct.
The Sixth Circuit has at least suggested it wouldn't. That isn't that your argument?
Well, my argument is that, you know, regardless of what the Sixth Circuit says, I don't believe that the video is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I don't. And I mean, the reason for that is, you know, in any case that I've been involved with, and in almost any case you will read about that has to do with a carjacking, then the facts are such that There is a live witness. There is a person who is able to either testify about what happened or to give some context to what a video might say. So whenever I've been involved with a robbery case, you know, on the trial level, the government introduces surveillance videotape. They also have a witness there who gives context to what happens. And that witness usually does a lot of work. That witness will explain, this is when they came towards me. This is what they said to me. These were, you know, this was the attitude that they had. These were the menacing words that they told me, which made me believe that I should be in fear for my life. We don't have any of that in this case. There's also no audio statement. So it's essentially a silent movie. And so we don't have any idea what was said to this person at the moment that made him drop his keys, or what was said to him to make him get in the car, right? What we've seen
made to the jury in closing argument, just the argument you just made now.
Those were the exact arguments that were made to the jury, Your Honor. And I understand the jury, you know, is afforded a lot of latitude, obviously, to weigh the evidence and to decide whether this case was proven. I mean, our position is that evidence simply wasn't sufficient to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. What I think it obviously proves is that these gentlemen, intended to frighten this person, intended to intimidate this person, but that is not enough under the Holloway case, right?
Do you know of any post-Holloway 2119 conviction that's been overturned on appeal, even though the carjackers are waving guns?
I do not. Of course we do not. If we had that would be the first thing I would be talking to you about today. What I have is I have the evidence, I have and I have my argument.
Yeah, it's good. No, I understand the argument. Do you know, if you weren't trial counsel below, do you know whether an empty threat bluff type instruction was requested?
The only thing I am aware of is that they requested the pattern jury instructions.
Pattern.
You know, if it was not there, then my contention would be that, you know, that would be reversible error. I mean, Holloway is a 1999 decision. For the judge not to have instructed on that would be material, and I think would have affected the outcome in this case.
But there's no, unless I missed it, is there a jury, do we have a jury charge issue on appeal?
Your Honor, I'm sure the jury charges are in the record.
I guess I'm asking, you know, it always worries me when on appeal, you know, this argument about jury charge. Obviously, the jury charge is to challenge the jury in the correct direction with respect to the evidence. And so first thing I'm looking for is, number one, the defense counsel asked for, you know, something other than the pattern charge, much as we've discussed, and the judge denied it, et cetera, so then that's an issue. On the other hand, if the judge, there's no pattern charge, if the judge sort of makes one up with counsel, then that's there. So I just don't recall that either of those scenarios are here. Generally speaking, if the court uses the pattern charge, they're kind of between the white lines. It's not impossible, but generally speaking, if they give the pattern charge and there's no objections to that, it's kind of a reach. Unless there's a Supreme Court, you know, intervening case or something that says, yes, the pattern charge, but, you know, that's not there. And I guess that's what I'm trying. I hear the argument, don't get me wrong, but I'm just saying if it gave the pattern, we'll hear from the government, the pattern charge, it wasn't a request for something specific, based on the evidence, et cetera, we don't have a jury instruction issue before us. We're looking at the patterns being given, the jury giving the evidence, and all the arguments. Just saying, how do we get to reversible error? That's my concern. Now, of course, the government's got the bearish burden. Now, don't get me wrong. Obviously, they got to bear the burden beyond a reasonable doubt, no matter what. Mm-hmm. But just.
Well, maybe Mr. Boydman will come in here and bail me out and will tell me that that's exactly how they were instructed. You know, I think my response would be is that when this court is reviewing the sufficiency of the evidence, you must take into account what specific intent means, right, as it's been interpreted by the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has said a very specific type of intent is required to sustain a conviction in this type of case. And we don't believe it's been required.
I'm not pushing back on that notion at all. But I will also, we're very deferential to jury verdicts. Civil or criminal, albeit, you know, their liberty is at stake. That's why we have appeals. And so if it's fact-driven, even though we might say, well, I don't know about that for me, but that's not our job. You follow what I'm saying? So I'm trying to see, well, where in the evidence it goes off the rails. And we ask the government, they're the ones that have the duty to prove it, but to argue reversible error, we can't just reach there because I don't think that was quite the deal. So that's why I'm asking the jury charge instruction. So if it's just based on the evidence, then I'm assuming these are the same arguments that were made to the jury. The jury rejected and came to its final. Well, that's just kind of one-on-one, right? So we'll see. So again, not trying to pin you to the wall, but just to know where the concerns are, that's why we gave this case oral argument. If it was slam dunk, we would have NOA'd it. You follow me? So anyway, those are the questions. And so you've reserved your rebuttal time. The government, you know, duty to prove it, so we're going to put them to their task, and then based on what they say, you'll at least know where we've plowed the ground.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, appreciate you. All right, Mr. Boardman, you've been doing this for a long time. Well, you know, if we got oral argument in this case, it must be not a screener or summary calendar one, but the government's got to put it on.
I understand, Judge. That's we were talking about that earlier. May it please the court. Before we start with the argument, Judge, first, I just want to sincerely apologize for the late filing of a very late discovered error in our brief that we filed our letter yesterday. I don't like doing things that late. I know the court expects better, and we do too. So I apologize to you and counsel for filing that as late as we did.
I didn't see it. Is it relevant?
Sure. In page 3 of our brief in the statement of the case, Your Honor, there's a statement where we say it's defining the carjacking, the count one carjacking with the video. We mentioned that Foster picked up the keys. We should not have said that Foster picked up the keys.
I was more curious. They both rely heavily on that post-Halloway Sixth Circuit decision, and I didn't see you cite it or discuss it at all. Right?
You're talking about Fakit?
Fakit.
I thought Fakit was in our brief, but if not, I can certainly talk about
it. Well, the reason it's important is, are you saying we're fine to live with Fakit's statement about brandishing plus, but we had more? Or are you saying we should split with the sister circuit and we should say Fakit's wrong?
I don't think you need to do either. I don't think you need to split, Judge Higginson, and here's why.
First, but are you therefore accepting that brandishing plus, there has to be something plus?
No, Your Honor, as I read Fakit with the brandishing plus, and first of all, I believe there was part of the concern with the Sixth Circuit in that case was that they weren't sure that there was evidence that a gun was loaded. And I think part of the brandishing plus goes to the fact that there's an unloaded gun brandishing it. The gun is loaded because I think the Sixth Circuit says in Fakit the presence of bullets in the gun can lead to the inference of intent. So they're dealing with an evidence of an unloaded gun there. I see the brandishing plus as the Sixth Circuit's effort to kind of say, how do we handle an empty threat when there's a brandishing? I really saw that more of that's their interpretation of what do you do when the unloaded gun is the only thing to differentiate from it.
The government's position is carjackers can show a gun and still, as a matter of law, be not have the scienter for carjacking.
That's not my position. I think that's what the Sixth Circuit was saying.
Okay, so you are asking us to disapprove of the Sixth Circuit.
I guess to that extent, I am saying I disagree that brandishing cannot ever be. That's from what we've seen. The reason I think you don't need to go there, Judge Higginson, is this case, especially with the first carjacking that's on video, even assuming Fakit is the standard, this is not a case that's limited to brandishing. Okay. And I want to distinguish that and make a point of that. I think there was a question you asked counsel about, is brandishing the only thing in count one? And it's not. There's so much more in that video, and that's something important here when we look at the common sense and the circumstances surrounding, which is what the jury was told to do and what this court always does. The evidence demonstrated specifically in both carjackings that there was much more than a brandishing. There were three carjackers in each. They targeted their victims, both times finding a way to get the victim in a situation where the victim could not escape. So he was trapped, showing more than a force, but that also leads to other things. They threatened and brandished a gun, but there was also physical contact and physical control of the victims in both situations. They forced victims into the cars. One of the carjackers sat in the back seat with the victims, and then they kidnapped the victims, exercising control the whole way. From all of those things together, you can infer what they were going to do when that gun was pointed out. So this is not just brandishing. To the extent you need brandishing plus, I certainly think you have that, but you have something much more. So I don't think, Judge Higginson, you need to reach that question, because even if you want to assume the Sixth Circuit is there and has it right, which I don't think you need, we have so much more. Because this is
not... So you know, I mean, Fakit seems to be at the essence of this. Is it a valid post-Halloway? Not in your table authorities. It's not discussed.
My apology, I thought...
But this discussion is helpful, but it was the principal authority they both relied on.
Agree, and it said, even taking it at face value, I think we can meet it under the Fekete standard, but I don't think that's certainly something you want. I don't think it's needed. I think brandishing the gun itself, especially in a manner, could certainly do it and should certainly do it. I don't think we have a case saying that, of course. Yeah. But again, here, even if the gun was, even if there wasn't a gun in this video, you still have what you need for a carjacking. Certainly 2119 does not require the presence of any weapon whatsoever. And I think it was Holloway that said this, or maybe, I think it was Holloway that pointed out, you know, the presence of a gun, loaded or not, doesn't have to be shooting. You can pistol whip someone. And let's talk about specifically the first video in here and what I'm talking about. From everything, the common sense and the circumstances from which the jury could show, could determine that they had an intent to seriously harm or kill the victim if necessary. If you look at the video, there's two videos. Government 18.1 is a color video of in front of the convenience store where the three carjackers are kind of standing and meeting and the victim goes in and out. 18.2 is a black and white video that actually captures the entire carjacking. What you see there is the three carjackers come around and they take strategic positions. One waits, one moves down against the wall, one goes further out right. Why is that important? Because now the victim, Eddie Prophet, comes in and he comes into an area of triangulation. That's when the gun is pulled. That's when the defendant, Dalton, walks up with the gun. Why is that important? How does that show intent? Because the victim can't go left because he's blocked by his car. He can't go forward because he has a gun pointed at him. He can't go to the right because there's a carjacker here. He can't go behind him because there's another carjacker, and that would be Foster, behind. So what do? They close in on him. Whether this is a gun or not, the victim throws his hands up very quick, drops his keys on the ground. He clearly understands this is a gun, so that issue shouldn't be there. But then, the two
did they ask for an empty threat bluff instruction?
I'm not aware of that. I don't want to guarantee, Judge.
If they did, that would be an appropriate instruction in a 2119 case, correct?
I think that would be appropriate because that's directly out of Holloway. Empty threats aren't enough. But what you see here in this video is not an empty threat. You have physical control. Two people come up and grab Eddie Prophet. They take things off of him. They move him into the back seat. They get into the car with him. There is constant control through every juncture of this carjacking, including when they finally drive away, kidnapping the victim. And that's something the First Circuit in Guerrero-Navarez, which I believe we cite, mentions that could be something to show the intent as well. And so this isn't a situation where it's a gun and what did he do? This is several things to show brandishing, control, constant use of force, constant threat. And when you have physical contact, which I think several cases that we cite, Adams, LeBron, Cepeda, I think are two of them, that when you have physical contact, that's sufficient for a jury to start inferring the intent. And then, of course, in the second April 12th carjacking, the gun that's recovered is loaded. So if you're looking at the gun alone, that gives even a more indication that the gun is, that there was a...
Do you have thoughts on, can a carjacker negate the intent element if they reassure the passenger that as long as they comply, they're not going to die?
I think that's a jury argument, certainly, but I don't think...
Would that suggest the opposite?
No.
If you don't comply, we will kill you.
Well, and this one, I think in the second one, there is the statement, if you don't be quiet, I'm going to kill you. That statement is actually made in the second one as well. But to negate the intent, I don't think it negates intent because we're still looking at the precise moment of the taking under Holloway. So if they intended to kill at the time they took and later on say, look, I'm not going to kill you, that doesn't negate the previous intent. I do agree it would be a jury call for what happens on the issue of intent, but the point of time is the point of time of taking. So if the intent exists there, it exists for the purpose of the crime. Now, I'm not saying you can't look to the future and the past, because certainly in identifying the, in inferring intent under the circumstances, we certainly look at the events before, during, and right after the crime, because all of that will be relevant to determine what was in the defendant's mind, something that was partly an issue in the Jones case, which opposing counsel cites was a guilty plea case. But this court affirmed there, looking and said the intent and the force intimidate, everything was there at the time, and you do that by looking before, during, and after.
Well, tell me, with respect to the April 10th one, Mr. Harrell argues that there was no evidence of threats or violence or force or whatever, whatever. You said, well, there was more. So just tell me in advance of, I haven't read the record,
sure,
what is the quality of the evidence that is more than the blend? I mean, what's the quality? You don't have to tell me detail, but give me a check. But what's the quality of the evidence that the jury would have had on the April 10th one to infer or otherwise find the specific intent?
Sure, Judge Stewart, and I do agree that the April 10th is all on video because the victim was deceased and couldn't testify. So the video is there. And I can't overstate how important that video is and how good the video is, because it actually captures the entire crime. From seeing, as I said, seeing the three carjackers get in position, waiting for the defendant to get in the middle, pulling the gun, walking up to him, then seeing two defendants come, grab the victim, take things off of them, and then move around, put the victim into the back seat, get into the back seat with them while another carjacker gets into the front. And I know opposing counsel talks that Dalton, who has the gun, walks off screen. He does eventually walk off screen, but he waits until the job is done. This was not a situation where two people put him and he drops the gun and says, I'm out of here. He's waiting around. The gun is brandished. When other cars are coming by in the distance, he moves it away to be seen, but it can still clearly be seen by the victim. And so the jury, Judge Stewart, got to see that video entirely. And that, it's, you know, very not often, I think, where we have an entire crime caught on video, but looking at the three carjackers doing all these things, establishing constant control, physical contact, and forcing into the back seat, that's sufficient for the jury to infer intent in count one. And that's also very similar to what happened for the April 12th carjacking, which didn't have the video associated with it, but did have the two victims saying exactly pretty much the same thing. They were parked, paralleled, could not get away. Someone comes up to them brandishing the gun in their face. They force them into the back seat. Another carjacker gets into the back seat. And then the other person gets in the drive and drives away, kidnapping. And the kidnapping is something that was police officers testified is very unique in carjacking. Something showing the signature and the relationship between the two and the defendants that were doing both these crimes. If you take a look at this, statements aside, like we're even staying a promise, we're not going to kill you, doesn't mean the jury was unreasonable in looking at the physical acts of control, the constant times, that the jury was not unreasonable in determining that they intended to seriously harm or kill the victims if needed at the time they took the gun. And I would say the same thing with the words dump in the April 12th, where they were going to dump them. I understand that the two victims were not experts in terminology, but I don't think that's necessary. The jury could reasonably understand when someone with a gun who's carjacked and kidnapped victim says, we're going to dump you all out. It's not too really much of a stretch to infer that could mean kill. And that's certainly what the victims took it to be.
They didn't bring it up, but just quickly, the predicament of a district judge who's going to depart significantly. Both these people got over 40 years.
Yes.
But then Judge Zaney decided he had to resentence. And the government's position is he didn't have authority to resentence because the notice of appeals had already been filed?
That's correct. The notice of appeal was filed, and then Judge Zaney vacated and said, I'm going to give notice of departure into the resentencing. So our position, looking at, we cite Lucero and Willis, which I think are very similar cases here in this. In fact, Willis, I even think, talks about an April and a July sentencing, which is exactly what we have here. That's the problem. Once the NOA has filed,
but to reinstate the original one, we've got to decide that his notice concern wasn't a valid or a legally deficient feature.
I think that's the judge's. Certainly that was what the district court said, Judge Higginson. Now, the issue raised on appeal is not that, of course. The issue raised on appeal is a reasonableness of the sentence. And I think that's part of the issue there. I don't think it would be a problem anyway, because even if what he did in the second sentencing, which of course is without jurisdiction, the court did notice upward departure, but also noted upward variance, so which of course wouldn't need a requirement. Now, while that's without jurisdiction and it's of no moment under Willis and Lucero, I think that's indicative of what you can do. But again, the only issue counsel has raised is the reasonableness of the sentence. I agree it's an issue. I don't necessarily think that would be reversible anyway because of the possibility of a variance, which doesn't require it. At most, I think the absence of notice departure could be a harmless error because it can be defended as an upward variance, which is what we've done in the brief. And I think here, what we said, you know.
That's fine. Thank you.
Yeah, so that's everything you need on that. I know that's a quick summary. I think I've tried to respond to everything. Welcome any other questions? Yes, Judge.
No, just, you know, I'm quick reading, but it just said, based on me, it's a sufficiency of the evidence challenge, although both in their sufficiency challenge traverse that the government failed to demonstrate the specific intent. And we've had the argument on that, but neither one of these briefs identify a jury charge issue at all. And they don't say that. They say insufficiency, the briefs are thin, but they don't say that. They do argue about specific intent, but neither one of them says, A, the pattern charge was wrong, B, should have been this, B, C, should have been Sixth Circuit charge. There's no jury charge issue here. I'm going to assume, and I don't see them in the record excerpt, the judge gave the pattern charge. Is that correct?
You know, again, I don't want to say yes. The instruction for this
just
would
like
be,
I would hold them. I don't really get the weird oral argument that I asked them. I asked the government, what was the charge given? And nobody knows the answer. Now, either the judge, this was jury tried. This case has been teed up. It just shouldn't be a mystery to me whether somebody tried the case or not to know what the charge was that was given. Is there a reason to assume that Judge Janney didn't give the pattern charge? We're going to look at the record. But that seems like a fair question in oral argument. What was the jury charge?
Understand, I can tell you we'll be around 1313 to 1317, I think is where it came up. I might be off a few pages, but that's, I believe that's the area of the jury instructions. And I think the issue with us, Judge, is that my memory is the pattern. I don't remember there being a fight about the other specific intent element. The empty threat, I do, as I agree with Judge Higginson, that would be appropriate, certainly, but that's just the law.
Well, that's what I'm trying to dig out. We're hearing our argument here about the jury charge and what the Sixth Circuit does and the Fourth Circuit does, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not briefed. It's not identified as an error on appeal. The specific intent piece is, and that notwithstanding, the government has the burden to prove it. So to me, then it starts slicing down. Okay, it's a jury trial. What could the jury infer from the evidence? You've already covered that. I just want to make sure everybody's clear on deck what is and what isn't preserved for appeal either side, and I just haven't heard anybody challenge the specific charge of brandishing plus or whatever. So we may be left with sufficiency in terms of either the video supplies it or doesn't.
And that's my understanding, is sufficiency is the only thing challenged. And even in the Fakit case with the brandishing plus, I don't think that was a jury's instruction in challenge either. I think that's just a sufficiency review. I don't remember that issue in Fakit in the Sixth Circuit being we should have argued brandishing plus to the jury. I may be wrong in that, Judge, but my memory is it was just a sufficiency review of it. Unless there are any other questions from the court, we would ask the court to affirm the convictions. We would ask the court for sentencing procedurally to vacate the judgment that was without jurisdiction, to reinstate the judgment from the sentencing of April 25th, which was with jurisdiction, and affirm on that basis. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, sir. All right, we're back to you, Mr. Harrell.
Good morning again, judges. With only 2 minutes allotted to me for rebuttal, I think the best place to start would be to determine if the court has any additional questions after hearing the allocutions from the government for me on behalf of Mr. Dalton.
Say anything about the sentencing?
Your Honor, we raised sentencing on grounds that we believed it was excessive in that it assumed facts that were not in the record, vis-a-vis mostly the April 10th carjacking event, and also that the reasons announced by the trial court were reasons we submit are already manifest in the statute itself and the sentencing guidelines pursuant to that, and therefore we believe that it was an abuse of the court's discretion.
So you've waived any argument as to procedural error in terms of?
We did not present it in our briefs, Your Honor. If there's nothing further, Your Honor, we would ask that the court reverse the convictions on a finding that there was insufficient evidence to establish the specific intent to kill or inflict great bodily harm, either with regards to the April 10th or April 12th carjackings, and we ask the matter be remanded for further proceedings.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Judge.
All right. Mr. Atkinson.
Very briefly, Judge Higginson, I think you asked Mr. Boydman whether there could be circumstances where a defendant could say something that would negate the specific intent to kill. I just wanted to be clear, our position is not that they later said something that negated an earlier intent. Our position has been that what they said later is the best evidence of what their intent had been the entire time, because their direct statements on this issue were actually pretty consistent. Pira, the driver, and that's important because he's the person who relinquished control of the car, you know, he testified that the driver definitely promised that he was going to let us go. They mentioned that they were going to bring the car back to me after they, like, do whatever they have to do, handle their business or whatever. And at the conclusion, he said, I promise I'll let you all go, so I'm letting you all go. There's one example of something that's markedly different from that. Mr. McGee got up and testified at trial that they did threaten to kill him. But I think it's important to look at actually what was said and when it was said. What he said was, I'm not going to kill you, but if you keep asking me this, I'm going to kill you. So there is a conditional threat. There's a conditional threat there, obviously. Right, but the conditional threat is not that if you don't relinquish control of the car, then I'm going to kill you, because that had already occurred much earlier. And that's the intent that the government has to prove. What the conditional threat there is if you keep aggravating, if you keep annoying me, you know, I'm going to kill you. So at that point, perhaps things had escalated, but that is not the relevant inquiry. The relevant inquiry is whether at the moment that he took control of the car, they had this specific intent. And I don't believe that Mr. Pierce's threat, as he articulated it, shows that they had that intent. Rather, I think that, and I'll wrap up, the intent was exactly what happened, which is that they would drive these people around and they would allow them to go free at the end of it, which is what occurred.
A nonviolent carjacking.
Well, that, you don't, Your Honor, our position is what our position is.
That was not a question, but just.
That's right. I don't think it was meant for a comment from me, so I'll let it go as it is. Thank you, Your Honor.
It wasn't. I probably shouldn't have. And Mr. Atkinson, you're retained, right? You're retained? Or both of you, CJ?
I'm a panel attorney.
Okay. All right. Well, just to say, and who Mr. Harrell is, the court richly appreciates the service of our CJ panel. In this case, in all cases, you get the cases as they're presented to you. You're able advocates. You didn't try the cases below, and so nothing should be taken from the court's questions of you in any way, undermining the appreciation we have for the noble calling of representing persons in all these cases. Your work in this case is excellent as usual, and we appreciate your continued willingness to take cases and present them in brief and in argument to the court. With that, the panel thanks you.
Thank you, Your Honor.